The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
That's a fine point. Conor was making a fine point during the break. Conor McGregor. Dear Lord. Really badly. Conor Pope, consumer affairs correspondent for the Irish Times and decent MMA fighter back in his day. Louise O'Reilly, Sinn Féin spokesperson for social protection and TD for Fingal West. And John Moran, Limerick Mayor and previously Secretary General of the Department of Finance. Conor, I was quoting you because you were quoted on the news saying we shouldn't panic. If you look at a lot of the coverage, panic would seem to be a logical inference.
Well, what I was actually saying was we probably shouldn't panic just yet because this is a long and it's going to be a very drawn out process. So it's not like we're standing at the cliff edge and we're about to step off it. To quote Donald Rumsfeld, or to butcher his quote, there are so many unknown unknowns here. We don't know exactly what's going to happen. We don't know the thinking of Donald Trump or his administration. We don't know exactly when the European Union is going to act and what it's going to do. We don't know if this is a tactic being used by Trump or if he's really serious about the tariffs. We don't know how the Chinese tariffs are going to impact the world. But having said all of that, this is incredibly bad news. So when I say don't panic, what I mean is don't panic just yet. But that's not to downplay the significance of these tariffs. And it's bad for the Irish economy. It's bad for the global economy. It's bad for Irish consumers. It's bad for American consumers. It's bad for consumers all over the world. This is an unmitigated disaster. And the one thing that has emerged, or the one thing that has become clear for me in the last week, is that Donald Trump has never watched Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Because in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, you know the history teacher, the boring guy who goes, Bueller. As a tiny little vignette in the film, he talks about the tariffs in 1930, introduced by Hawley Smoot, and that plunged America further into the Great Depression. And that's inevitably what the tariffs are going to do. And the other interesting thing about the tariffs is, I think David McWilliams had a really good piece in the Irish Times yesterday, and he pointed out that the formulas being used by the Trump administration for these tariffs would fail a student doing the ordinary level economics in the Leaving Cert in Ireland. It's just insane.
On the topic of David McWilliams, a pal of his is the Nassim Nicholas Taleb, the man who wrote The Black Swan, Fooled by Randomness, all of those books. And you said about the thing of with tariffs, the lack of predictability and certainty. Taleb is making a point online where he's saying that one of the difficulties is that the only way tariffs will work and cause adaptation by industry is if all parties assume that they are permanent, therefore allowing you to plan long-term, move factories to everything else. But that's one of the main problems I would have thought with the Trump tariffs. Nobody's sure if they'll be here next Tuesday.
That's exactly it. And that's why, you know, there's an awful lot of concern about what's going to happen to the pharmaceutical industry in this country in particular. And if we just focus on Ireland. But the pharmaceutical industry takes a longer view of this stuff. And they're like, well, we're not going to relocate all of our manufacturing to America now if in 2 years' time or if in 3 months' time or if in 2 weeks' time this is all going to be reversed. So it's just, but the problem is the uncertainty. And the uncertainty is feeding into this sense of crisis that we're all experiencing. And ultimately, that uncertainty could be the undoing of the global economy longer term.
Which is what the front of the Sunday Indo says, government in crisis mode, public braced for recession.
And you can see that people are concerned. So in the Sindo poll, it says 56% of people are extremely or very concerned. The difficulty is at this point in the proceedings, it is those mangle that phrase, the known unknowns or the unknown unknowns. People don't know what it is yet that we have to be concerned about. 75% of people, according to the poll, think that we that this is going to precipitate a global recession. But I don't know that we've worked out the nuts and bolts of what that actually means for people. The real threat, what Trump is doing is an act of self-sabotage. You couldn't describe it as anything else. It is going to hit ordinary Americans in their pocket. And, you know, the state of ordinary working people in America, a lot of them are living in very, very precarious circumstances. That, you know, that phrase living paycheck to paycheck is a very, very real thing in the lives of many people living in America. And what Trump is doing is going to impact on them first and hardest. And I think it is that will cause him to change his mind. But the point that you made earlier, Anton, is the correct one. Nobody can plan for this because nobody knows if this is permanent or not. So, I mean, I think the cool heads, absolutely. I think the job of the government now is to really link closely with the European Union to ensure that they understand the unique situation that we have here. They also need to protect our all-island economy. So like, there's practical things that the government can do.
And of course, the differential in the tariff between UK and Republic of Ireland.
Yeah, and the framework agreement as well. But again, there's nothing in this that can't be worked out, but it requires more information to come from the states in the first instance, and then a conversation about how this is going to work. But I think that requires a meeting of the North-South Ministerial Council. So there are practical things that can be done that we would like to see the government moving on. And I think those requests are reflected in the polls. So people are nervous, they appear to be anxious, but now is the time to start sharing that information. So when we say we're looking for things like the Taoiseach to convene all of the party leaders together, that's to share information and to ensure that we have, because my constituents are going to be as concerned as anyone else, as I want to be able to share with them whatever information that I have. So there are practical things that the government can do, both domestically and internationally, that they should be doing now and doing quickly.
John, how does this process, or how does a process like this, because this is largely uncharted territory, unfold? Because if you take the Irish economy, we have concerns about butter and dairy exports, we have concerns about things like whiskey. Undoubtedly, France will be looking at wine industry and aviation, whatever it might be. 27 member states all trying to protect their own interests and come to joint negotiation. When you were back in finance, how does this sort of happen?
Yeah, look, I think the most important forum probably now is going to be the forum of finance ministers, in Europe, who'll get together. And it was one of the things that when we were back in the old days, I was always pointing out that every dossier matters. I mean, whether it's olive trees down in Spain, you have to understand each country's interests and stuff like that. And I think Europe has evolved a lot since the last crisis. I mean, we saw that in Brexit, the ability to come together. We saw it in the Ukrainian invasion. The fact that some countries are more impacted than others comes to train. But I think now, I mean, I think the government's doing this, but as was said, they have to show leadership, right? There's a domestic leadership and there's an international leadership. I want to do this separately. I think in Europe, it's explaining what we're doing. I mean, I'm going over to Paris the end of this week and hoping to meet the international head of the Chamber of Commerce in Paris. It's just all information gathering. At the end of April, I'll also be meeting the mayors in the UK, trying to find out just what's going on and try and feed that back. But then I think here at home, there's a really important thing, and it was said about this panic. I mean, the first page of the Sunday Independent is probably going to drive us into a recession, because the recessions happen when people think next year is actually going to be worse than this year, and they tighten their belts, they stop spending and things like that.
But how could you not think that in this context?
I think you can, but I think there are things that the government can do to try and reassure people. A lot of the conversations and the numbers in the newspapers this morning about the 60,000, 80,000 jobs, if you read it carefully, they're the new jobs that we're not going to have. So it's kind of a growth that we expected that's not going to happen. And so it's really important now, as we did going back to 10, 12 years ago, to try and have interventions. The government has more money than it had then, but have interventions that continue to stimulate the domestic economy.
Now, where do we stand with the rest of our European colleagues? Because for a long time, there was pan-European resentment about our tax regime and what we had achieved in FDI with it. And there will undoubtedly have been a sense that it is barely a wet week since the Commission and rest of the EU and the world and the IMF had to bail us out. We're now going to be saying, can we get help in relation to the tech sector? Can we get help in relation to what may happen with medtech and with pharma? Have we any political capital to spend on that?
I think we have. I think Brexit showed that some of the work that was done during the last crisis, Europe standing together. I mean, often people used to describe that Ireland took one for the team at the time. And in many ways it did in the earlier parts of the financial crisis. But the dividend of that has come back at us fairly hard in terms of the European support that we got around Brexit, where in a way we were the outlier. This is different. I mean, I think I would be a lot more worried today if Ireland had been singled out for a separate tariff rate, because I think it would have made it much harder for us to get the European support we'd need at the negotiating table. This is now a one single European, and you can see it. I mean, Macron is going for the tech industry. He's making, I think, a valid point that Trump likes to focus on this as being a trade imbalance, which is related to physical goods. Whereas in actual fact, when you get into services, it's the other way around. And that's one that is probably as, if not more worrying for us than in some ways the pharmaceutical one, because pharma is a huge exporting industry for us, but a relatively small employer. The tech industry is quite a different, if you walk around Dublin, as I was yesterday, you can see a huge number of people that are actually involved and in, you know, employed in the tech industry. So it's a different dynamic.
Have we not got a good chunk in pharma when you take Lilly and Pfizer and all the US giants, particularly west of the Shannon? Have we not got a...
You do, but relative to the amount of exports and value that's created on goods per employee, it's a very different analysis. You know, Eli Lilly, for example, in Limerick, have to put €1 billion into a facility at the edge of Limerick. But it's only a couple of hundred people working, which is an important couple of hundred. But it's not 5,000 or 4,000 like around the corner in Google.
So what do we then want in terms of the EU response? Because we have yet to see it. Do we want the EU to keep its powder dry? And
absolutely, we do. I mean, we want a very measured response, because it's only going to be what we need are cool heads at the moment. We don't need the European Union imposing reciprocal tariffs on the United States and ramping up the trade war, because we're all going to be losers in a scenario like that. So I would argue, and Lord knows I'm no economist, but I would argue that, like, just slow and steady wins the race here. Lord knows what we might do in the longer term.
Not just capitulation.
Well, we're only talking about, like, what I would say is that we don't react in the next week, 2 weeks. We have to do it as a kind of a coordinated effort across the European Union. I'd be a little bit worried about the pharma sector, and I know you say that, you know, there's relief that he hasn't come after the pharmaceutical industry yet, I think is the key word there, because, I mean...
Well, Howard Lutnick has said that very clearly.
And he's called us, what, Ireland is his favourite scam. I mean, that kind of inflammatory language does nothing. And I think when you're faced with that kind of inflammatory language, it's important to take the heat out of it without capitulating, but just saying, OK, there are more reasoned, mature people in the European Union looking after this than might be the case in the United States. And that's kind of has to be the hope. And that is, and it is all hope at the moment, because Lord knows we've never been here before.
What about supports for industries?
Yeah, there are things we can control. I mean, you know, the government needs to be honest about this, right? We are heading into this potential trade war, which, you know, I believe should be de-escalated. Nobody wins in a trade war. There are no victories in a trade war. But the government need to be honest with people and say, we are heading into this not in great shape, because we have obviously we have a housing crisis, we have a crisis in access now to water and access to wastewater, we have equally got an issue with the grid. So there are things around infrastructure, critical infrastructure and places for people to live, that the government have allowed to deteriorate to the point now where we are not in a good condition. Now, that's not me saying that necessarily, although we have been saying that for a long time. That's actually people, organisations like the American Chamber, like IBEC, they will point to housing and critical infrastructure.
Indeed, I think you're
as
pushing an open door with most people on that one. Go back to your thing.
Can I just come in there? But I think that's one of our strengths, right? So we have a fairly decent war chest, right, sitting in terms of savings that the government have put aside. It's now really important that that's used in a way that buffers the economy from shocks. So things like housing, things like digging holes to put pipes in, they're relatively high labour intensive. So they give a safe net for everybody in terms of doing it. The more houses we build, that brings down the cost of housing. So actually, there are things. I'm more worried that the government sort of panics into suddenly sending out checks to everybody. You know, a universal measure to kind of calm things down. That's not what we need now. We need to be very targeted in the way we spend the money over the next year or two. And as was said by Conor, it is a setting your time horizon in years. I mean, either Trump is going to very quickly capitulate and come back to sort of a situation where he realizes the self-harm, or we're in a year, we're in a changing world over years, and how do we manage that? How does the rest of the world come together as a single trade?
And what about specific industry? Because the Business Post has broken down. They have interviews with a couple of CEOs, John Teeling from Teeling's Whiskies in there, people from Glanbia, etc. And Teeling's is saying something to the order of about 40% of their sales may go off a cliff by virtue of this. Likewise, if you're producing dairy products, you may lose an entire market.
But there has to be a balance, Anton, between... So I think the government need to signal that if need be, they will be prepared to step in, okay? But I don't think that that is necessary. Now, what they need to be doing now is looking at where potentially there's going to be an issue. But there's two ways out of this. Government supports are only one way. You can also diversify your markets. You know, the fact that we failed to diversify our indigenous industry over the last number of years, that should serve as a wake-up call. Now is the time to be looking at our businesses as they grow. And when they get to that critical kind of 10 million mark, that they should be encouraged to scale up rather than sell up. I think that's really, really important. And that was something that we had included in our manifesto as a way to kind of put us on a stronger footing domestically, which is essential. So yes, it might be that the government should look at potentially supports will be needed into the future, but we need to start looking now so that they're ready to go if need be, but also looking at the other way to do this. So 40% of your business goes to the States. Can you reorient your market to other areas where we're going to be able to establish a deeper trading relationships? And also, we don't know how long this is for. Is it for a week? Is it for a month? Is it for a year or a decade? So I think we do need, we are at the stage now where it is information gathering and information sharing to the greatest extent possible.
Now, just one thing on that. You said the phrase of de-escalation. I'm sketchy on, because a number of people have said that we don't want to be, and that was your point as well, Conor, we don't want to be in an all-out trade war. How do you avoid it without just rolling over?
Discussions and negotiations. And
with the Trump administration.
Yes, because they are the ones, you know, it's not all around one man. That is around negotiating with the State Department, negotiating with the officials.
But they're in lockstep to say that they want to force jobs and industry back to America. That I don't see how you negotiate unless you break that fundamental ideology, and there's no sense that they want it.
Well, the alternative is to stay at home and panic, and I don't think anybody wants that. I think what we need to do is
the Mark Carney approach not an alternative? Yeah,
approach? I'm not as convinced about the no do anything. I mean, I think we talked about history earlier. I think this is not just a whim that Trump has developed up. I mean, you know, I was in a bookshop yesterday looking for a book on McKinley, the US president, to try and understand what was going on in the 1800s, because he has clearly indicated in a number of speeches his admiration for McKinley. McKinley was ultimately following the same playbook, but at a different time. I mean, he was doing it at a
very
time when,
different time. But I'm not sure. Deglobalized world. This is a highly globalized
even
world.
Within the US, it was a very different time. I mean, 3% of government spending was what, or 3% of total GDP was what was on government spending. It's now 30%. So it would require a total rollback, which would be unacceptable to everybody of the social welfare system, everybody
they're
else.
They're having a go.
They're having a shot at it. And that's why I think that's the understanding we need. But I do also think that the Mark Carney playbook of sort of literally setting it up, I think what Louis says is absolutely right. The world needs to be clear that it will do what it can over these number of years to work without the 350 million Americans who have assumed that they are an essential part in the mindset of the rest of the world. I mean, the Europe as it is 400 plus million, right? So as a market. But I do think that we run a risk if we go into this without any clear indication of what's on our side of the table in the negotiations. If it is going to be a relatively short one,
I think
he's just going to try and reduce from 20 to 10 and see that as a victory, and we still suffer.
In relation to Mark Carney, let's not forget, Mark Carney is in election mode. And his utterance are, and it makes it slightly different. I had really, and of course it's not good to name drop, but I did have occasion to meet him a couple of weeks ago when I was in Montreal just 2 days after he had been after he'd been sworn in as Prime Minister. And I saw a man campaigning very, very much in campaign mode. He walked the entire length of the St. Patrick's Day parade. He shook hands with absolutely everybody. Everybody along the parade route sang him a happy birthday, because that was for the day that was in it. But very much in campaign mode. But there's a phrase in Canadian ice hockey where you go in and you're, you know, exactly elbows up. And the thing that I noticed along the parade route, where people with signs, holding up signs saying, one, Canada is not for sale, and secondly, elbows up, we're heading into this. But they are heading into an election, and their politicians are very much in campaign mode. I think for us here in the European Union, we need to
But
know.
Carney doesn't, I assume, abandon all that he knows because
exactly.
He's an
elected.
It's to do with how you deliver it, and his presentation is that of a man who's campaigning.
But
versus,
the theory
those
applying.
People who maybe have time for calmer heads, a little bit more information, and prepare ourselves for those negotiations.
But Louise, I was often in rooms with Mark, and he is the adult in the room, or was the adult in the room in a lot of very tense negotiations back 10 years ago.
This is when he was governor.
When he was governor of the Bank of England. And even before that, when he was in Canada. And I think that when he comes into those situations, he's coming with what I don't think Trump necessarily has in terms of a real considered view about what is the right way to deal with this, embedded in a deep understanding of global economies and everything else.
And all of that is absolutely worthless if he doesn't get elected, which is why he's in campaigning mode now, because as he is now a politician, not a banker, it is the job of every politician to get themselves re-elected first and foremost, and thereafter nothing else is of any value, because you can't achieve it if you are not sitting at the table. So right now he is in campaigning mode, and I mean, you can see he's the support is absolutely swinging towards him because he is standing up to Donald Trump. But I think for us, our situation is slightly different, and I do think, you know, the what our government needs to do is be about the business of standing up for us in Europe and making sure that our interests are protected and that the uniqueness of the all-island economy is made known to those people who will be negotiating, but and that they know how important
it
is. But
in so doing that, within one really important European dynamic, right? We cannot just go into a European negotiation thinking about just Ireland. Right. If you're going to have a European negotiator in the negotiation room in the White House, not us, because we effectively have no ability to do that, you need to start with what's right for the broader Europe in terms of standing up 400 million people against 350. And that's why I think the Carney playbook is really interesting, because he actually made it very clear to the Americans that if necessary, even though they were doing an act of self-harm, that Canada was also prepared to do that. And it's a little bit Cold War kind of like. It's like, who's going to eventually be the one to press the button, right? And everybody eventually has to climb down, whether it's back in the Cold War or any other time since, because the two acts of self-harm are just so...
But this brings it to the cohort that Connor is responsible for looking after. If we do that and we start following the Carney playbook, that's when the Irish consumer really starts to suffer, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
But I mean, I think the interesting thing here is how American consumers are going to suffer first and foremost. Exactly. And Trump is a populist. And when he sees the stock market is tanking, when he sees that there are more people on the streets, when he sees that the price of eggs is climbing again in American supermarkets, he could very quickly reverse his course. But and I think that takes us back to where we started. The reason why I think maybe Irish consumers don't have to panic just yet is it will take a little bit of time for the consequences and the impact of the tariffs to hit Irish consumers. But when they do, they could impact inflation, they could impact interest rates, they could impact grocery prices, energy prices. Like, we're all going to feel the pain in an incredibly significant way if this happens.
But ordinary Americans are going to feel it first.
That's the thing.
And that's when Trump will feel it, when it is impacting on people, and it will.
Trump doesn't care about measured voices in the room. Trump cares about whether or not he's popular with Fox News and Newsmax or whoever it might be, and ultimately that's going to be the thing that sways him. Yeah.
And when their listeners start texting in to say they can't afford to, you know,
and Lord
to
knows
live from
Joe Rogan might turn against him, and then it's all over.
The fate of the planet hinges on Joe Rogan. What a prospect.
I don't forget, while all this is going on, there are lots of other problems in the world.
That's
in some ways the distraction that this is causing and the difficulty.
We'll have a look at some of those problems affecting the rest of the world, including some of the political findings in that poll in respect of the presidency and who might win it, the position of the various different party leaders and their popularity, and some very interesting coverage about the level of targeting there is for teens online and the kind of damage that's been done after the break. A text say, Trump obviously has nothing but disdain for us and the EU. If his treatment of Zelensky is anything to go by, what makes us think he'll negotiate with people he sees as weak? He responds only to strength. Back after this break. It is News Talk. It's the Anton Savage Show. If you'd like to get in touch, 53106 at a cost of 30 cent or 087 1400 106 on WhatsApp. With me in studio is John Moran, Mayor of Limerick and former Secretary General of the Department of Finance, Conor Pope, Consumer Affairs Correspondent with the Irish Times, and Louise O'Reilly, Sinn Féin Spokesperson for Social Protection. To Irish politics, that Ireland thinks poll, Louise, there's a breakdown that relates to speaking rights in the poll there. Whether or not Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael should have done the deal with Michael Lowry, whether or not Ken Corla, Verona Murphy acted fairly in her handling of the speaking rights in the Dáil, should the opposition move on? Should the opposition continue? It is the numerical evidence of a plague on both your houses. Should the opposition move on? 57% say yes.
Well, I think people do want to see politicians getting on with the business of doing their work. But those people, I think, are going to be very, very shocked when they find out that the government have set back the establishment of committees by up to 5 weeks. It'll now be the 8th of May at the absolute earliest when committees are established. So I dearly love to go back.
What difference does that make then?
Because committees are where you scrutinise legislation. Legislation is a very important part of the work we do.
in the Oireachtas, and we won't have committees up and running. But again, you know, the committee
would say surely that's the opposition's fault.
No, it's not at all. Nobody would say that with any credibility, because we offered on the 4th of February to establish the committees, but now that they have forced through the cementing of their grubby little deal with Michael Lowry, they now have moved to delay the establishment of committees. And, you know, we've been told that the thinking is it will be the 8th of May at the earliest. So that's, you know, and when committees are established, they have to elect chairs, they have to do a work plan and all of that. But that's just another avenue of accountability that the government have managed to shut down. So I would like to go back to those people and ask them, you know, what their opinion is now, given that the government are effectively shutting down yet another avenue of accountability for members of the opposition. And when I say opposition, I mean real opposition.
Explain a bit of this to me, Conor. One of the things the opposition did very well throughout this whole period was staple Michael Lowry to the government, to Fianna Fáil in particular, and to Micheál Martin most notably. And at the end of it, the state of the parties asked about first preferences, Fianna Fáil is up 3.
Absolutely. Yeah, that is confusing, because they also, when asked, do you think Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael should be dealing with independent TD Michael Lowry? I think 67% say no, but that just shows the complexity of the Irish electorate, perhaps.
they can walk and chew gum. I've met some of them. They are intelligent people, and they can hold two views at the
They absolutely
time.
Are. And I think Micheál Martin probably did himself some good by his turn in the White House earlier or last month. I know that Louise probably doesn't agree, but I think broadly speaking, people were going, well, God, he was in a really tough place, and he managed to get out of it unscathed, or relatively unscathed. Parts of it were definitely cringeworthy, but yeah, it was a difficult... I don't think anybody could have played it much better.
Yeah, Keir Starmer didn't exactly come out covered.
Nobody has
in
covered themselves in glory visiting
either.
Trump, let's be honest. So I think he's got some credit for that, and he has seen a little bit of a bounce. In terms of the other leaders, everything is pretty static, same as it was. And I think that'll probably be the case for a long time to come, because we've just been through the election, and that's why the poll of looking at the presidential candidates is probably more interesting, because that's the thing that we're facing into in the short to medium term. And I think that's more illuminating as to how and why or what the kind of decisions people are looking to take.
Are you surprised by any of what it reveals? Because there's a couple of candidates whose names have been knocking around, who I think will be disappointed by the percentages. I mean, Barry Andrews on 3, Francis Fitzgerald on 3, and Mairead McGuinn is starting to look very much like the front row.
I think it's really early days. We were talking about it before we came into the studio, and I think, you know, it's possible that the winner of the Áras, their name isn't even on the list here.
I would tend to agree with that. I think this is a... early speculation. There's going to be no poll until November anyway, and I don't think we'll see serious contenders emerging until around about the end of September. It's a very bruising campaign. Everybody knows that. I think that, you know, people will be at the stage where they're thinking, would they be interested in the campaign? So I think there are maybe people sitting at home listening to this thinking, I could make a good president, but I'm certainly not going to show my hand just for the moment. And I think that it's likely that our president, our next Uachtaráin na hÉireann, is not among those that are being speculated about at the minute. Now, I mean, that's not
you
to say
that... You think it's a total outsider that may arrive and take it?
I think there are people who would be considered insiders who aren't on that list yet. And I think we'll see... We'll see. There is actually, if you look, Conor Murphy's on it, but that's not why...
You're writing him off at this early stage.
I think what we'll see, though, but Conor's written himself off. He said he's no interest in it. So he's already made his view
still
clear.
Early days.
But that's the point. It is early days. I just don't think we're going to be talking about I think the person who will emerge as the front runner, and there's no doubt about it, Mairead McGuinness is certainly on every poll. She appears to be gaining support, but there's a long way to go, because every single party, if they're going to put forward a candidate, they have to go through a nomination process.
Ask, as a seasoned politician, would you advise non-politicians to do it? Because I'm always surprised by people deciding, I'll take my first electoral flutter at what is the most bruising and nightmarish campaign you can enter in this country.
I would say, you know, to people, look, if you're good enough to get the nomination, because the nomination process itself is quite tough. So, you know, to go through the nomination process and to put yourself out there, that's tough enough in and of itself. I mean, I would encourage anyone that's interested to get involved in politics. I'm not sure that aspect of political life would be one that would appeal to very many people. But the first hurdle is getting a nomination. And, you know, that'll be for within parties, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, etc., if they do choose. And I think they've both said they will be running candidates. But that's an internal party battle in the first instance to get yourself onto the nomination. And then the crack really starts when the actual campaign is up and running. But I do think we'll be talking about this now probably for the whole summer, and there'll be a lot of mad speculation. I'm going to take this opportunity, Anton, if you don't mind, to just fully rule myself out, because it's not that anybody has asked me, but, you know, just in case.
I was going to say, John,
I haven't asked, but I'm actually ruling myself out as well. But I think there's an important point.
Hang on a minute, let's get
I was thinking about it, but then you said it was a really bruising kind of affair, and I don't know if I fancy that.
Yeah, but once you're in, you're in.
But I live in the neighbourhood, so it would be just a short little hop across.
Well, you see, that's the good. You've got to consider that, you know, if you could get up the hours on your bike.
The serious thing about this election, which we sometimes often forget, is it's a bit like the mayoral election. It's a bit like a by-election. The candidate that will emerge and, you know, to win this election is one that has broad appeal. You know, and so I know there's been a lot of speculation about one or other candidates in the last while, but you have to get 50% of the electorate plus one, if essentially, to be elected. And that's why these elections have very different dynamics than, say, a general election campaign with a five-seater constituency. And so it's very easy for somebody to look like they have 20 or 25% of support and become, and I'm not saying anything about Murray because she's an incredibly strong candidate, obviously, with a great CV. But at the same time, the question she's got to be asking herself today is, how do I get from 27% to 50 plus, you know, and that's a much bigger jump.
Sorry, I don't be argumentative now, but the question she has to be asking the question she'd be asking herself first is, how do I get the nomination off of Fine Gael? If she doesn't get that, sure, she could be as popular as she likes, but that's not going to make any difference.
And polls like this will really help her in that.
I would say if they put
her at the front runner, like Fine Gael aren't stupid. They're going to go, well, listen, like, if she's got 27% now, we give her the nomination and she could be home and host.
And one of the other things is actually I had forgotten about that I saw it in there, is that in order to get a nomination through the Oireachtas in terms of Dáil Shannon, you need to have 20, I think it is, votes. So that actually means that there aren't that many parties in our Dáil or in our Oireachtas that can themselves pick a candidate. So it's going to require coalitions of smaller parties to come together to nominate candidates, or, as Louise says, go through the rather bruising job of getting county council.
How many county councils? Just four county councils. So that does leave a lot of scope for a lot of people if they want it, doesn't it?
Well, not necessarily, because most of the people on county councils are members of a political party, and if they're running a candidate, they're unlikely to support somebody else. And, you know, I mean, I would like to see a little bit more discussion about maybe a unified left candidate. Let's see who emerges from that. Obviously, there's a lot of talk about Frances Black, a very prominent human rights campaigner, etc. But there are others in that space. So, you know, let's see who emerges from there. And
unified left rather than a Sinn Féin specifically.
But I'd be interested in exploring it. I don't think that the left should opt themselves out of this conversation or opt themselves out of this contest. I don't know if there is scope there. That's being honest. But that's why I'm saying to you, it's very early days. Like, we're looking at a whole rake of names here. Chances are somebody else is also out there. And, you know, there's nothing more certain than we'll find ourselves in the aftermath of the election going, oh, well, it probably was always going to be that person in the end. But at this stage, we really don't know about a
role that actually has relatively little power, and 50% of the people in the same poll want us to be talking and finding solutions to housing. You know, so I think it's also important that we kind of, you know, don't forget the important stuff. You know, an Oireachtas that's still not functioning properly, major problems like housing, major investment needed in getting that done, and water infrastructure, as Louise said earlier.
Although I assume on the thing of the Oireachtas no longer functioning, at this point the government must be seeking to find any possible way that it can to get out of the speaking rights deal and just move on with stuff.
I would have thought so. I mean, you know, I think at this stage,
it's been in their gift all along to resolve it. The Céim Corla made a ruling in February and she made a decision and published it. And on that basis, we need to establish committees. But the government just are blocking and delaying the establishment of committees, which I find absolutely intolerable.
Final word, Conor, if you did get it, would you like it as a job?
Oh, I think I'd be great at it. God, you're, the way you're looking at me, I'll say, no,
total consensus of silence.
I was expecting Connor to ask me for a nomination after this.
I said that entirely in jest.
I am a councillor, Connor, so afterwards we can talk.
Yeah. Clear. That was a joke.
I think we've got a hair running at this point. Guys, thank you very much. Connor Pope, Consumer Affairs.
You heard it here first.
The Irish Times. Louisa Riley, Sinn Féin spokesperson for Social Protection. And John Moran, Limerick Mayor, former SecGen for the Department of Finance. We'll be back after this break with the news.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.